Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Since the end of the Cold War, the U.S. has pursued an ambitious foreign policy. When faced with mass atrocities in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Libya, we intervened. And we forged a new series of agreements in the areas of trade and nuclear arms control. But many feel that the U.S. overstepped when it used military force to topple Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, while at the same time prosecuting a war in Afghanistan. Neither country is stable to this day. Stephen Walt is a leader in the realist school of thought. He has now written a new book entitled The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. We'll be talking to him about his key findings. In the second half of our program, my co-host Ray Suarez will cover the likely policies of Brazil's president-elect, Jair Bolsonaro. He will be in conversation with two regional experts, Paulo Sotero and Peter Heikim. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. The focus of the current book is, it's called The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of the U.S. Primacy. He focuses on, Steve, you focus on the era since the end of the Cold War, so since 89 when the Berlin Wall fell, or 91 when the USSR came apart. Who ended the Cold War? Was it us or was it them?
Well, the short, easy, and I think correct answer is both. I mean, obviously, the end of the Cold War was precipitated by the collapse of the Soviet Union, a process that we had a lot to do with, but was also the function of the mistakes that they had made, the limitations of the Soviet system, the fact that nationalism had returned with a vengeance, the Warsaw Pact was slowly rebelling, the fact that Gorbachev's efforts to reform the system had unleashed a series of forces that ultimately spun out of control, out of his control. But at the same time, the United States played a critical role in how it ended. And in fact, I always use this as an example of the value of diplomacy. Because when you think about it, ultimately the victory in the Cold War was a victory not secured on a battlefield. It wasn't primarily due to the triumph of the U.S. military over the Soviet army, thank goodness, but rather it was done over a negotiating table, where mostly the first Bush administration, late President Bush and his team, negotiated the peaceful dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, the reunification of Germany, managed the turbulence of the Soviet breakup without it spinning out of control, which it could have done, and managed to do this all, you know, sort of by accommodating and making various promises as well to the Soviets / Russians through this. So when you think about it, it's one of the great successes of American foreign policy that we managed to come out on the upside of this competition, but at the end of it then managed it as smoothly and peacefully as we did. And again, it was primarily a remarkable diplomatic achievement.
One of the great worries of people who are students of international relations was that in the process that Russia, the successor state, would feel humiliated. There was a lot of suffering. There was a rapid impoverishment of many when all the subsidies were suddenly gone and the Soviet Union was gone. There was an opportunity for great resentment and backlash amongst the population. How did President George Herbert Walker Bush manage the process with that in mind, sort of avoiding the humiliation that you saw of Germany after World War I?
I think both he and Secretary of State James Baker showed remarkable empathy, not at every moment. They played hardball in a number of places, but they showed remarkable empathy for what Gorbachev in particular was going through. But most importantly, they also made some promises, which the United States ultimately did not keep. The most important one was that NATO would not expand beyond the reunification of Germany. And the eastern part of Germany, when Germany reunified, could be considered then part of NATO, but we would not extend one inch eastward, is I believe the phrase that Baker used. And Gorbachev and his team made, I think, a fundamental mistake at that point by not getting that pledge in writing. right? It was an oral assurance made more than once, and it's been the source of much dispute amongst Russians, Americans, and historians ever since, exactly what we promised to do or not do, whether it was binding or whatever. Much trouble, I think, could have been avoided had the Russians insisted that that pledge be put formally. It's possible we wouldn't have been willing to do that, by the way. But I think they understood, Bush and Baker understood, was that there was a limit, that even though Soviet Union was breaking up, Russia was going to be a very weak country for, it turned out to be at least a decade, there were limits to how far you should push them, because they weren't going to be weak forever. And as you said, if you fueled a very powerful sense of resentment, if they had the opportunity to try and alter the circumstances later on, they might try.
So the Clinton administration did make that decision, though, to expand NATO right up to the border of Russia, and then offered, I forgot what the partnership was called, Partnership for Peace, was it, that was to be our relationship with Russia. Do you have a sense of what went into that thinking at the time?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things. And there really was a fork in the road in the early 1990s. The Clinton administration's initial policy, as you said, was Partnership for Peace, which was extended to the former members of the Soviet bloc, but also included Russia. And it involved many of the things that NATO membership might have involved. There could be military-to-military cooperation, various ways to upgrade their different militaries, working on civil-military relations. It was designed in part to ensure that democracy would flourish in these places as well. It did not involve, however, an Article 5 security guarantee from the United States. These were not going to be members of NATO. We were not going to be formally committed to defending them. And of course, Russia was going to be involved in that. And shortly after that was the U.S. policy, we switched and we decided to pursue NATO expansion, beginning with Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. And that was an internal fight within the Clinton administration, as you probably remember, that was ultimately won by the advocates of enlargement. And what they believed, and I think genuinely, was first of all, that this was not anti-Russian. They didn't intend this as a way of, you know, containing a now weak and prostrate Russia. Secondly, that this would extend a zone of peace into Eastern Europe, that along with EU membership, this would solidify democracy here. These states would have to conform to NATO's normal standards for being a democracy, and that because democracies don't fight each other, all right, this would actually make Central and Eastern Europe more stable. Right, and that would ultimately be good for Russia, too. Having stable neighbors to the West would be better for Russia. So there was a certain optimism. This is all going to be easy to do. It's all going to go well. And what people, I think, forgot was a more sort of realpolitik view of this, that no great power really likes another great power pushing its alliances right up against your border, because you never know what's going to happen down the road, and that once Russia was in a position to oppose that, they were going to do everything they could to stop the process. Just one final point. The second thing that NATO ultimately did, which I think was a mistake, was to declare that this was going to be an open-ended process, that there were no limits to how far we might take this. We were going to be careful about who we let in when, but ultimately NATO membership was an open door that any state, once it qualified, could be a part of. When you think about that, this is a highly revisionist strategy we're following. We're basically saying we're going to just keep moving this thing as far east as we think it can go, and that involves altering the local politics in various places. And I think eventually this proved very alarming to the Russians, and they reacted as many people had predicted.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this was an inflection point for us and for the West generally, but there were other things that occurred during the period that your book covers, as well as the collapse of the Soviet Union, the ending of the Warsaw Pact, and that is globalization turned into something very real with real impacts that the U.S. saw as mostly positive,
right.
Created great wealth, it lifted millions from poverty, particularly in China and in India, but it also left folks behind. There
right.
was also a decline, you know, the middle class was experiencing a declining standard of living. To what extent did the reality of globalization shape the way a Bill Clinton looked at the world and looked at his foreign policy and even his national security options?
Again, it was this, again, this remarkable period of optimism. I mean, we all thought the wind was at our back, that we'd reached the end of history. Bill Clinton in 1992, actually one of his little campaign lines was that the cynical calculus of power politics does not compute. It is ill-suited to a new era. So, you know, democracy.
That's a long sentence for a campaign slogan. Yeah.
Well, Bill was a voluble guy. But all of these good things were supposed to go together. Democracy was going to spread. The rule of law was going to spread. Markets were going to open up. China was going to develop, continue developing. And as it did, it would become more like us. It would become democratic. It would get a middle class. That middle class would want political power. Parties would form. It would become another democracy. And democracies don't fight each other. So that means peace as well. We're all going to get rich in this wonderful world in which power politics is going to be essentially old think, and our only problems are a few pesky dictators in a few not very important countries who haven't gotten the memo yet that this is all behind us. And that proved, unfortunately, not to be true, obviously, with Russia, but it also proved not to be true with China in a couple of senses. China didn't liberalize in the way many people anticipated that it would. It turned out there were other ways you could be a modern industrial, post-industrial economy that didn't involve necessarily being a democracy. And second, we probably accelerated China's entry into, say, the World Trade Organization before it had a legal system at home that would guarantee intellectual property, before it was really willing to play by the rules it was signing up for. And again, I think that was based on the Clinton administration's belief that the way to deal with a rising China was to embrace it, bring it into our various institutions, socialize it into how the world actually works, and they'll eventually be welcome, be adopted, will follow essentially the same set of standards. And that, I think, proved to be erroneous as well. The second part of it was, of course, that globalization did not deliver quite as promised. As you said, it was very good for the Asian lower and middle classes, who benefited greatly from this. It was very good for the 1% here in the United States, who did very, very well. It was not very good for the lower and middle classes in the United States and in Europe, who were adversely affected by it in a number of different ways, and by some things that had nothing to do with globalization, such as increased robotics, automation, and things like that. One final point, we also were creating a global system that was much more fragile in terms of finance. That as financial markets opened up all over the world and we relaxed controls here, we were setting the stage for the financial crisis of 2008, which had real repercussions in other places, most notably Europe. Causing the euro crisis, which they're still not out of.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, there was one other thing, and that was 9/11. And also the experiences in Europe with terrorism. And that really dramatically affected the way George W. Bush looked at the options he had. One thing that was surprising about that moment, one thing that was wonderful about that moment, is the way in which the West united around, and you know, the phrase "We are all Americans" was a very warming, heartwarming phrase coming out of France. But that moment of 9/11 and others gave most of us a sense of vulnerability we didn't have before. Right. So you've got the combination of globalization making some feel quite vulnerable. Reality of terrorism making some people quite vulnerable. At that moment, a leader has to decide, you know, gee, do I go hell-bent for leather? Do I come up with a very dramatic new program? How do I think about constraints? And we ended up with the war on terror without a strategy and without a budget. Well, I guess that's pretty common, number one. This is not only George W. Bush that falls into that.
Right.
But how much did the war on terror really reorient the way we thought about the world, or were we already on the course of trying to spread democracy as our central mission?
Well, that was certainly the Clinton administration's policy. And as you and I have chatted before, Bill Clinton got very lucky in that there are certain things he did as president where the negative consequences only came home to roost after he was president. So NATO expansion is one where the real backlash happens subsequently. And I think there were some aspects of Clinton's approach to the Middle East, the policy of dual containment, for example, which involved keeping lots of American forces in Saudi Arabia after the Gulf War, was part of what led to 9/11 as well. And that, again, happens on Bush's watch, not Clinton's. But Bush did have a choice. Right? He had to respond to 9/11, but he didn't necessarily have to respond in the way that he did. So he could have, first of all, done something more like Roosevelt. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And of course, the Bush administration went exactly the opposite direction. We're going to inflate this. We're going to make people think that terrorism is really a huge problem that has to be rooted out everywhere around the world. We're going to declare a global war against all violent extremists, even though the actual risk to Americans was still remarkably small. He did nothing to try and deflate the threat. He, in fact, did everything to try and make us as scared as possible in order to, in my view, justify, first of all, greater assertions of executive power, something Vice President Cheney had been in favor of for a long time, and then to provide a rationale for the invasion of Iraq, which is something people in his administration had been advocating long before September 11th. So instead of a very focused campaign against the people who had perpetrated 9/11, against Al-Qaeda, and say going to Afghanistan and really focusing on catching them, this became a global campaign, the results of which we all have seen. You know, thousands of lives lost, great instability in parts of the Middle East. The United States will ultimately have spent, you know, $4 to $6 trillion on those two wars, which could have been spent in all sorts of more useful ways as well. So Bush had a choice in September 12th, 2001, and in my view, he chose exactly the wrong road.
So you raised the war in Iraq, and I can't help but think that those two wars, Desert Shield of George Herbert Walker Bush, meant to push Saddam Hussein back from Kuwait, and Desert Storm, his son's war, designed, one of the arguments for it was that it would become a democratic state by getting rid of, if you have regime change, then you'll have a democratic state. What was the organizing principle for policy with Bush 41? What led him to make the choices he made, stop before going into Baghdad, and what was the organizing principle for George W. Bush? Because there were many arguments put forth.
George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41, was you could argue, the sort of last realist president we'd had. Both he and his close advisor, Brent Scowcroft, really are sort of old-style Republican realists, and I think even though they both recognized that the United States was far and away the most powerful country in the world, they also recognize that even the most powerful country in the world faces certain constraints and certain limits. And there's some things that either are very hard to do, whether you might not even be able to do, or would be unwise to do. So he correctly understood that Saddam Hussein's seizure of Kuwait had to be opposed and reversed, for reasons mostly having to do with maintaining a balance of power in the Persian Gulf, ensuring that Iraq didn't become even wealthier, then become more powerful, start threatening other countries in the region. So that had to be reversed. But he also understood that, first of all, international law did matter, and the UN Security Council resolution did not authorize the coalition to go to Baghdad and depose Saddam Hussein. It authorized them to throw Iraq out of Kuwait. Secondly, that once you went to Baghdad, you owned the country. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea how to run the place once we got there. And if you are interested, you can find on Google a series of remarks that Dick Cheney made before he became vice president defending the elder Bush's decision not to go to Baghdad. And I only wish that the older Dick Cheney had gone back and listened to the younger Dick Cheney, because he identifies very cogently all of the things that subsequently happened. So the elder Bush did understand that you would lose international support instantly. You would end up with a country that would eventually want the United States out, that it would fuel an internal division, because Iraq was a deeply divided society that had only been held together by a great deal of coercive force. And unfortunately, his son didn't understand that. His son, I believed, drank the Kool-Aid, as they say, and was convinced that something dramatic had to be done in the Middle East in the wake of 9/11, and in particular, that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein would be step one in a process of regional transformation. That first we'd knock off Saddam, then we would put great pressure on the Assad regime in Syria. We would also put great pressure on Iran, and eventually we would take these countries that we didn't like very much to begin with, although we had worked with Assad in the past, and turn them into a sea of pro-American democracies. And of course, once they're flourishing democracies, terrorism won't be a problem either, because we know terrorism never emerges in a democratic society. Not true, but never mind. They really did believe this, and I think they genuinely believed it would be easy to do and it would be cheap. And understand that this is happening in the wake of the initial American invasion of Afghanistan, right, where we go in and throw out the Taliban, and everyone told, or people said, well, wait a second, you know, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. It defeated the British. It defeated the Soviet Union. Don't go there. And the first 6 weeks to 2 months look remarkable. The American military looks magical. The Taliban is gone almost instantly. Well, after the initial experience in Afghanistan, it was very hard to argue we couldn't overthrow Saddam Hussein easily as well. Again, our military can do anything. And of course, in both cases, the problem was not getting rid of the current regime, which were both relatively weak and brittle. The problem was what you did with the society afterwards. And it turns out, you know, it's easier to remove a government than it is to build a new one, to create one in its place. And again, the only thing worse than having a bad government is having no government at all.
So if you've got George Herbert Walker Bush focused on defending sovereignty, you've got George W. Bush focused on promoting democracy. When President Obama comes in, there has been developed within the UN structure a concept called responsibility to protect, right, where you're protecting humanity. I mean, there's this, it basically argues that that every head of state has an obligation, every leader has an obligation to protect their citizens from mass atrocity. If they fail, the international community has the right and perhaps the obligation to, right, step in. So the first sort of action on that was Bill Clinton when it came to Kosovo and Bosnia. Right. And his inaction when it came to Rwanda is probably what haunts him to this day. Obama was faced with Libya and Syria. Right. Very, very different choices and a very different response. What, describe his response to Libya and give us your views. Is there something else that would have been wiser?
Yeah, Obama has said that his decision to support the British and French intervention in Libya and eventually then to topple Muammar Gaddafi was one of his great mistakes as president. He now regrets, and I think his regret is appropriate, not because Muammar Gaddafi was worth defending, but because Muammar Gaddafi had put together this sort of ramshackle state that unfortunately, once it disappeared, left anarchy. And the only thing worse than a very bad government is no government at all. So I think Obama agonized over it. I don't think it was an easy call for him. He was pushed very hard by some of his advisors to do this and eventually agreed to initially go along to, as authorized by the Security Council, to prevent the Libyan government forces from possibly, because we don't know what they would have done, but possibly conducting a massacre in a rebel city, Benghazi. And that mission quickly expanded to become one of aiding the rebel forces who were attacking Gaddafi and eventually throwing him out of power. I think this was a bad idea for two reasons. One is, of course, what's occurred since then has been essentially a warlord now governed society where they're still fighting each other. So it's been very bad for the Libyan people. Arguably no worse than what preceded, but certainly no better, and maybe worse. But second of all, the United States had promised, as part of Libya's decision to disarm, to get rid of all of its own weapon of mass destruction programs, we had promised to leave Muammar Gaddafi in place. That was the quid pro quo. All right, and so it set a very bad precedent. However, the United States having promised to leave the guy in place when the next president comes along and participates in his overthrow. And when you think about some other countries out there who we would like to keep from getting weapons of mass destruction, we are setting the wrong lesson. How do you persuade Kim Jong-un to give up his nuclear arsenal? Well, we'll promise him that we'll leave him in place. We won't try to pressure, we don't do regime change. Well, the first case that the North Koreans always point to is Libya, and you can understand why they might do that. It did one final thing, which was that it was one of the many straws that helped, I think, break the back of U.S.-Russian relations as well, because mm-hmm. the Russians had gone along with the Security Council resolution. I believe they abstained on it, yeah. Right, authorizing us to go in and protect civilian life consistent with R2P. Once we did regime change, the Russian reaction was, we can't believe anything you're saying, any assurances you make about your limited objectives in other places. And many people believe this played a role in their response to the Syrian civil war as it broke out as well.
That's where I'm going to take you, is did we make the right choices with respect to Syria? And as you say, the die was cast as to what the relationship would, whether Russia would be as permissive in this event.
I think Syria is one of the hardest cases to think about because it's impossible to see what's happened to Syria and not want to have done more to prevent it or to stop it. I do think the Obama administration mishandled it in a couple of ways, but not perhaps in the way you're expecting. First of all, they very quickly said Assad must go. So the American policy, once the uprising began, was that, well, this guy is toast. He should be removed from power. Even though we didn't have a plan for doing it, had no idea what would or who would replace him, so we shouldn't have said that. Second, Obama himself misspoke in the famous red line statement, which I think was kind of impromptu, about chemical weapons use, which he then walked back from, but that undermined his credibility. Third, it is a myth that the United States was not involved supporting the various opposition forces. The United States was involved from the very beginning, backing some of the anti-Assad people. Not very effectively, but we were there, and some other American allies, including Saudi Arabia and some of the Gulf states, were also involved, backing different forces. What we should have done, in my view, is from the very beginning said, we have to shut this down as quickly as possible. You know, long before you have 500,000 people dead, back when there were 5,000 dead or 10,000 dead. And the problem there, and there was negotiations that we tried to sponsor in Geneva early on to try and bring some kind of accommodation or settlement, but we insisted that Iran could not participate in these negotiations, mm-hmm. even though Iran was one of the principal backers of the Assad regime. This was a recipe for complete failure, because you can't exclude one of the key actors and expect to get an agreement that actor is going to want to live with. And Iran, whether you like it or not, was in a position to affect that particular outcome. So if we could roll the clock all the way back, we would have been better served to say, we don't like Assad very much. We don't think what he's doing is very good, but we think he might have to stay in power for a while. We're going to organize a peace conference where all the interested parties can come and attend, and we're going to try to shut this down quickly. We are not going to get a perfect outcome here, but we might get an outcome in which a lot of Syrians are still alive and the country hasn't been destroyed.
And don't have the migrant crisis for...
Then, yes, and lots of other things don't happen as a result of that. By the way, one final point. Obama, I believe, made the decision, rightly or wrongly, not to get more deeply involved, not to use the American military to try and remove Assad, because he believed something like Libya might happen, that it could actually produce a worse outcome, that various al-Qaeda-associated groups might take power, that ISIS might, in fact, emerge as a dominant force within Syria. And, you know, therefore, removing Assad, loathsome as he might actually be worse than leaving him in there. And, you know, people can debate that back and forth, but I think there was a valid reason for operating that way.
I'm going to take you to a very different case in the region, and that's Yemen, where I think we first were involved under the Obama administration because of concern about al-Qaeda in Yemen. Is that right?
Well, we've actually been involved in Yemen off and on for quite some time. But
for that reason, primarily?
Primarily concerned with, in several cases, trying to promote democracy. We helped engineer the departure of the previous sort of strongman ruler. Saleh, and we have intervened in various ways, especially after 9/11 and when an al-Qaeda-affiliated group emerged in Yemen. And I would argue, to a first approximation, almost every time we've gotten involved, things have subsequently gotten worse. So there's no great success story there yet. Mm-hmm. And now it's become, you know, a great humanitarian tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost unimaginably horrible.
Right.
Famine, cholera. How do we get out in the way that hurts the least, that's most protective of the people?
Well,
is this a war? Do we have the leverage with the Saudis to bring this to an end?
I think we have leverage with them. It will ultimately, reflect not just the pressure we might be able to bring to bear on Saudi Arabia, but ultimately what happens inside the country as well. I don't think there's any outside power that can come in and sort of dictate a solution mm-hmm. and organize it. But certainly, if it were me, I would be making it very clear to Saudi Arabia that we're no longer going to support their military actions there. Partly because they're, have created a humanitarian crisis, and partly because they're not successful. Right? This is, worse than a crime. It's a blunder. It's a great humanitarian disaster, but it has also been an unsuccessful military campaign that has not removed the Houthis from power in the areas they control. And for both of those reasons, this war should be shut down immediately, and we are in not necessarily a position to dictate a solution to it, but we can certainly stop supporting the military campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons that I think you argue that the primary reason that we have kind of gotten into this kind of consensus that it makes sense for us to be exporting democracy and that we can, I think it's a narrower consensus, that we can using force. You argue that part of the problem is that the foreign policy elite just talk to each other, that there's not a great distance between the conservatives and the liberals, it's an echo chamber. And in fact, you use the phrase "the blob" to describe us. And I should note that you include in the blob World Affairs Councils. So everybody should start worrying about being in the blob. Define the blob.
Yeah. So the term "the blob" was actually coined by Ben Rhodes, who was Deputy National Security Advisor for Obama. And I don't use it very often because I actually think of the foreign policy community or the foreign policy elite as somewhat broader than what he meant. What he meant by the blob was really inside the Beltway think tanks and mm-hmm. the various folks who are constantly engaging in debates about foreign policy inside Washington. And he used this as a sort of derogatory term to talk about how hard it was for Obama. Do anything and the blob starts resisting you in various ways. World Affairs Councils are maybe part of the periphery of that, but you're a force for good overall. The point I make about the sort of broad foreign policy communities. First, it's a pretty consensus-based group. You think of politics and foreign policy as being, sharp elbows and lots of infighting, but in fact, there is remarkable consensus on the broad outlines of foreign policy, and you can see that in multiple ways, and I have a lot of evidence in that particular chapter. But, just one sign of it is the reaction of foreign policy experts to the arrival of Donald Trump. So, of course, his candidacy is opposed by the Democratic Party and the army of foreign policy advisors who were helping Hillary Clinton. She had like 200 VIPs signed up, as advisors to her campaign on foreign policy, as befits a former Secretary of State. But Republicans were, if anything, more vehement in their opposition to Trump, right? Some of you may remember there were several open letters signed by over 100 former Republican national security and foreign policy officials condemning Trump in really remarkable terms. One of these letters calls him utterly unfit for office. And again, I reiterate, these are Republicans writing about Trump after he's the nominee, right? And so you sort of say, well, what's going on here? Well, it's because there was, in fact, this considerable bipartisan consensus on the United States being the number one power in the world, constantly exercising global leadership, being indispensable, to use Madeleine Albright's phrase, and to be using its power to promote classic American liberal values far and wide, to try and as much as possible to transform the world in America's image, peacefully if we can, but in some cases through the use of military force. And Trump, rightly or wrongly, had taken dead aim at many of those sort of key principles in some of his speeches and remarks. This was horrifying to, quote unquote, the blob, which is why both the Republicans and Democrats within it opposed him. And it's why when he ended up getting elected, he had hardly anybody available to appoint to any key positions, because there was nobody on his team who had much experience, much knowledge. And it's one of the reasons you've seen such a haphazard foreign policy coming out of Washington ever since.
One last question that's really focused on public response. We've been in several of our programs taking a look at what appears to be a real shift from liberal democracy to illiberal democracy. Yeah. Around in fact every continent, every region of the world, I should say, not every continent. Is a large part of that this kind of overreach, a situation where the sort of Bill Clinton school of thought has made too many sort of obligations on the economic and political front, and a sense that George W. Bush got us overextended militarily with a promise of spreading democracy through the use of force. Is that, are those two factors part of why there's a sense of, you know, a little less faith in that our system works?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there, it's not, it's, some of these trends are due to forces in particular societies as well. So the United States is not solely responsible for the, what you might call the populist backlash or the authoritarian backlash that you see in a number of different places. Some of that, I think, reflects the history and culture of some of these societies as well. But in certain ways, we didn't help. As we talked about before, globalization turned out to have wrenching social consequences that people didn't anticipate, that those who were not benefiting from it were going to react to it in various ways, that make facilitating migration, however desirable in the abstract, was going to have destabilizing consequences in some places, including here in the United States. The second part of though, is that the United States no longer looks like the world's most desirable export brand. So The Economist magazine publishes an annual democracy index that surveys the state of democracy around the world. And last year, The Economist magazine, which is not a left-wing publication, I want to be very clear about that, downgraded the United States of America from a full democracy to the category of flawed democracy. Right, based on governmental dysfunction, voter turnout, a whole variety of indicators that they use. So if the United States wants to promote those values, wants to make our style democracy look appealing to others as opposed to more illiberal or authoritarian versions, fixing things here at home would be a good way to do that. And the problem is there's only 24 hours in a day, 7 days in a week, only so much money, even in a wealthy country like this. And every hour that a president spends trying to figure out how to broker an election in Afghanistan or trying to figure out which warlord to back in some country that ultimately doesn't matter very much is an hour that he or she is not spending figuring out how to make our electoral system work better, figuring out how to get jobs for people who are being displaced by automation, figuring out how to deal with the opioid epidemic, figuring out how to reform the criminal justice system. So those people in America who think the United States needs to spend more time nation building at home are basically right. And if the United States of America starts looking like a really wonderful country that everyone should want to be part of, then, you know, other people in other parts of the world are going to say, I'd like something more like that in my country. I think that's actually a better way of exporting our values than doing it, you know, either with the 82nd Airborne or with economic sanctions or with the other tools that we've been trying to use.
So please join me in thanking Stephen Walt.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Stephen Walt on what he sees as an overly ambitious foreign policy agenda and what a wiser approach might look like. After the break, my co-host Ray Suarez will be joined by Paulo Sotero and Peter Heikem to discuss the recent election of the right-wing populist Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. And now to the second half of our program. Brazilians have elected a nationalist populist, Jair Bolsonaro. He has said he intends to be one of Washington's strongest allies and to borrow much of his international agenda from the Trump administration. But analysts are divided on the question of whether the incoming president will be able to follow through on his campaign promises. My co-host, Ray Suarez, will lead the discussion with Paulo Sotero, director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Peter Hakim, president emeritus and senior fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you might have missed, you can download our podcast on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Paulo Sotero and Peter Hakim, it's great to have two men who've been watching Brazil closely and for a long time. So for Americans just starting to catch up with the big changes in Brazil, Paulo, who is Jair Bolsonaro?
He is a former army captain who left the army and started a career, was later elected to the Brazilian Congress and has been there, I think, for 28 years. He saw the opportunity in the failure of the Brazilian political class to respond to the challenges of the country. He mounted a campaign very efficient using social media, and he shocked the country. It was really a tsunami, his election. People rejected the past and rejected especially the Workers' Party of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, which became from that social transformational figure in Brazil, became completely identified with corruption.
Peter Hakim, as Paulo mentioned, Jair Bolsonaro will take the oath of office, become president on January 1st. What shape is his country in? What will he be taking the reins of in just a short time?
Well, I mean, this is probably the reason that he was elected. He's taking the reins of a country that's been seriously damaged over the past 4 or 5 years. It's a country whose economy has just passed through its worst recession ever and is undergoing a rather uneven, uncertain, stumbling recovery. Plus, it's had an epidemic of corruption, with more than 50% of the politicians in Congress under some sort of investigations for corrupt activities, leading businessmen, people in the executive branch of government. Third, the crime and violence is sort of penetrating throughout the country now. It has one of its worst years for homicides in Brazil. In other words, there's really a situation where things have gone very badly. And by and large, the mood of Brazilians is rejection of their government. They've lost faith in their institutions, in their political leaders, in many of them in democracy itself.
Writers internationally love to see trends and portents and wider ideas in one country's political process. And I'm wondering if Bolsonaro is in response to particularly Brazilian conditions, or as some columnists have suggested, a part of a global trend with Viktor Orban in Hungary, with the new Austrian government, with Donald Trump in the United States. Some have called him the Trump of the tropics. Is there something afoot worldwide when we look at Jair Bolsonaro, or is it a particularly and uniquely Brazilian set of circumstances that leads him to be taking the oath in a few weeks. Paulo?
Well, I think that there is something to it, especially regarding Trump. I don't think that the other leaders that you mentioned are very much on the Bolsonaro's radar. He probably learned about their existence very, very recently. But in terms of Trump, yes, they are stylistically similar. They are both populists. And Bolsonaro has, I think, taken a page from Trump's playbook, political playbook, to run his campaign. He used social media effectively. He bypassed the whole structure of electoral politics in Brazil. And he apparently has struck an initial dialogue with President Trump that seems to be, headed into some promising directions. But he remains to be seen. As we know here, the American president likes very much he wrote a book about the art of the deal, is to a diplomacy that is geared towards results and not process. Well, Brazilian diplomacy is famously for valuing process over results. Bolsonaro, in order to make something out of this relationship with the United States, I think would have to change the traditional strategy. I believe that he is willing to do it and to confront certain to change or to challenge certain traditional positions. Since his election or even during the campaign, he said some things that looked like Trumpian, but then he reversed himself.
Peter Hakim, is Jair Bolsonaro the Trump of the tropics?
Well, I think there's a lot of differences between Trump and Bolsonaro as well. Trump really was a man who had, whether you think of him in this way or not, had some real successes, both as a businessman and as a star of U.S. television. Bolsonaro, more than anything, has been a fringe, leader of the fringe, very small fringe element in the Brazilian Congress, very much off the charts. And before he became president, Donald Trump actually took control of the Republican Party and showed how strongly he controlled the party. The problem is Bolsonaro is coming. He depends on forming coalitions. He starts off with a pretty good chance of putting together a coalition that in Congress that will allow him to govern. His party's members only occupy 10% of the seats in the Brazilian Congress. He has to ally with lots of others. Trump came in with more than 50% of the Congress people in his party. I think that Paulo underestimates the difficulties that are going to face Bolsonaro. His problem, unlike Trump also, Trump came to power at a time the U.S. was doing pretty well. The economy had come back. It was starting on an upward swing. Federal Reserve was raising interest rates already. It was one of the best performing economies in the world. And Bolsonaro comes when the country is at one of its lowest positions ever in terms of its economy. And we've talked about the crime and violence and the corruption way worse than the U.S. In other words, Bolsonaro has a terribly difficult job, doesn't have his own base of power, and he's a man that has not accomplished a great deal, although I don't want to underestimate him because he did accomplish winning the presidency of Brazil, which is in itself an accomplishment.
Is there some risk? Does there have to be a sort of high-level calculus in the new Bolsonaro administration on how to steer a course between the United States, which Bolsonaro has been very complimentary toward, and China, which has emerged to become one of Brazil's main trading partners.
Bolsonaro is not a man who spent much of his career on foreign policy. And he himself admitted when asked about economic questions, he says, I don't know a lot about economics. I'm going to leave that. And he gave the name of a prominent Brazilian economist who very much is welcomed by the Brazilian business community. But the point is that Brazil really has some fundamental economic problems that even the best managed economy over the next few years is going to find it difficult to resolve, in part because the politics make it very, very difficult. The one critical reform that everyone agrees on is that you have to change the pension system, which pays out too much, takes in too little, and is headed for a real collapse unless something is done. And it takes a big portion, the biggest portion of the Brazilian budget. But right now, I think Brazil is in a very precarious position economically. And this is, I agree with Paulo, this is going to be Bolsonaro's biggest challenge. If he does not get the economy moving upward or people perceive that he's doing the right thing, he's going to find himself in grave political difficulties, I would say, certainly within a year, maybe even earlier.
Paulo, on the world stage, can people around the world expect Brazil to sort of be relocated in the political space? Is Brazil now going to be a different kind of player on the world stage and joining a global right such as it is?
I doubt it because there are very compelling reasons not to, and to be practical. Bolsonaro had announced this business of leaving the Paris Climate Agreement. Well, it is not. He made some noises about China, that China is buying up Brazil, etc. Well, they are engaging in conversation because it happens that Brazil is China is the largest trading partner of Brazil today, as it is to many countries in the world. China is also a supplier of some investments to Brazil. So, and a beneficiary, by the way, a great beneficiary right now of the U.S.-China trade war. Brazil has now, I think, is the largest supplier of food to China because obviously the trade war got the U.S. out of that game, or mostly out of that game. Ray, I don't know if you're going to see Brazil as this part of this right-wing club. I kind of doubt it. I don't think that many areas in businesses in Brazil, this automatic association with the United States, I don't think that there is much sympathy to that, including among Brazilian military. But there are deals. There are things that could happen that would get the two countries much closer.
Peter Hakim, do you agree with Paulo's analysis there that Brazil is not entering a new club of the global right after quite a lengthy spell of left-of-center leaders who were staking out a new direction for the country and wanted Brazil to punch its weight internationally?
I think that one has to start with the supposition that Bolsonaro's views are not going to change radically suddenly because he's become president. He's become president because he wanted to press forward with those views, and his views tend to be radically conservative, whether on the social issues regarding gay marriage, abortion, what have you, whether they're on the economic issues, whether they're on fighting crime and violence, which is a very big issue in Brazil today. He has been a very hardline law and order. Like I say, it was very not a single analyst that I spoke to before the election thought that Bolsonaro really had a chance, before the first round of the election had a chance of winning this, because he was so different than anybody else who had occupied the Brazilian presidency for the past 40 years since the military left office. I think that he would like very much to see himself join with Trump. I think he appreciates Trump's particular temperament, his bullying, his many of his positions. I think, on the other hand, the prospects of Brazil and the United States finding productive cooperation is really a long-term enterprise. Brazil and the United States have always been friendly, cordial to one another. They welcome the diplomats from one another warmly. But in the end, they found it almost impossible to really cooperate on critical issues internationally or regionally. They found themselves either disagreeing or simply not wanting to get involved with each other. And it's shown more than anything in the trade patterns. Yes, the United States is Brazil's second largest trading partner, but Brazil sells to the United States about 10% of what Mexico sells. Yes, Mexico is on our border, but China isn't on our border and sells 10 times what Brazil sells to the United States. Brazil has just never been able to engage the United States, whether on economic issues, on political issues, very easily. So the two countries are friendly. They're not rivals, they're not adversaries, but to come together in any significant cooperation seems very difficult. And Paulo mentioned one area that's going to be the one big objective of U.S. policy under Trump has been to reduce the footprint of China in Latin America, that they are very concerned that this is sort of taking the U.S. back to perhaps a Cold War. And they really are beginning to talk about the Monroe Doctrine again. And the fact is, Brazil is so deeply engaged with China on the economic front. 80% of its agricultural commodities exports are sent to China. China is a huge investor in rural areas, in transportation, in ports. And it's just very hard to imagine that the U.S. and Brazil could come anywhere together on that issue.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. The first half of our program featured Stephen Walt of Harvard University. In the second half of our program, we heard from Paulo Sotero. He's director of the Brazil Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And Peter Hakim, President Americas and senior fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue. They were in conversation with my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.